C1T. Number 8B.
Again, here, as before, and even afterward, in this chapter, she shows also that with that spiritual consciousness, you have to deal with sin differently than with sickness. And you can see when you read the text how she juxtaposes, what is the verb? Yeah, that's the noun. And the
juxtaposes.
Okay, you know what I mean? Those two methods. She says, when you treat sin, first see the claim of sin, then destroy it. When you deal with sickness, first mentally unsee the disease, and then you will you can destroy it. So can you see those two differences? With sin, we must see through the case. With sickness, we have to unsee disease and see that there is no such a thing as sickness. Whereas with sin, we have seen before, we must first analyze and uncover and annihilate sin before we free ourselves of sin. Yes, that's a teaching out of one's own spiritual consciousness. And then we come to the last tone of love, where we have the climax again of that consciousness of a Christian who is a scientist. My epitome reads that every is always the oldest sense of love that does not exclude anybody. Every Christian scientist can demonstrate Christian science successfully. So she climaxes and says, if you follow really those that principle and that rule, there is no exception for anybody not to do it, not to be successful. See, here she brings in really the scientist and saying, well, teaching and healing are abilities that can be cultured through science. They are not abilities that you have got as a gift of God and falling into your lap and you didn't have to work for it. You hadn't really to culture it. So in any science we say, yes, everybody can learn arithmetic. Yes, everybody can learn really chemistry. So here she says, everyone can really learn or understand Christian science, teach it and practice it, if naturally he has gone through the line of development, of spiritual development, as she has shown it in the textbook. So there are naturally requisites for it, and in this passage here, Mrs. Eddy gives quite a long number of requisites that are necessary. And they all naturally turn around the scientific system. Namely, the requisites are systematic teaching, spiritual growth of the student, experience in practice, adhering to the rules, imbibing the spirit of the Christ, abiding strictly by the rules of Christian science, heeding every statement, advancing from the rudiments laid down. Can you hear? All these qualities are actually qualities of a scientist. They appeal not to the religious people, to the religious sentiment. They appeal to a scientific thinker. And she says, and if you really abide by these qualities, you will be successful, but you will fail if you don't adhere to them. You fail if we divide our interest between God and mammon, if we substitute our own views for truth, very important, that's not the scientist that does that, and practicing truth only in part. So this is the end of this, that shows that actually everyone can practice it and teach it if he has gone through the scientific training that is taught in the textbook. That finishes up that whole tone of truth. Again, now if we go over it, I think you can more or less remember them, or we can help it, but just try. And we say, now Mrs. Eddy comes along and says, you know, in order to be a teacher and healer, you have to become a Christian scientist. How do you become a Christian scientist? At the point of mind, she shows that man must be a law to himself, that he must be willing to be led by the leadings of the divine mind. All right, now where does it lead to, that divine mind? Says, oh, Spirit tells you where it leads to. It leads you away from the world, from matter, and leads you towards Spirit. And that way you can advance further. But if you advance further and you come away from the strictness of the material laws into the wide field of Spirit, soul says, you know, you must be cultured and restricted to the rules of science. There is no wild freedom. You have to adapt yourself to the strictness of the structure of a science. What structure of a science? A principle tells you that there is such a structure. Namely, the science of being is not just a science, but it shows that it is a science that is constituted of classification and relationship between these classifications. Therefore, it needs some kind of an intellectual momentum to be willing to accept this scientific system. That was principle. Then we came to life afterwards and showed that we must now practice this truth of being, that ontology. And only by practicing this ontology we will not be a mischief maker, will not be a smatterer in Christian science. And practicing this ontology brings us to a new consciousness, which says at the point of truth, out of that consciousness which evolves within you on the basis of ontology and practicing and pondering and devoting yourself to that ontology, that gives you a spiritual consciousness, and out of that spiritual consciousness you should only teach and heal. And who can do that? Fundamentally, at the point of love, she says, fundamentally everybody can do that if he wants to be a scientist. Therefore, if he submits himself to the requisites of a science, and then she gives some requisites of that science. Isn't that clear? Clear as a bell. Yes. All right. Well, that brings us to the last subject, love. It wasn't so easy to epitomize this last subject. I felt I could perhaps epitomize like this, that teaching Christian science demands, again, strict adherence to what? To love, namely to the motherhood of love, that motherhood of love that includes the idea, which naturally involves accepting divine self-completeness. So love is always that which is fulfilled, which is perfect, which is complete, and the motherhood sense shows that self-completeness that is right there from the beginning of being. What is that self-completeness? completeness? How are we aware of that self-completeness? And Mrs. Steady starts at the point of mind again, and shows here at the point of mind that self-completeness rests on mental self-knowledge. You have mind, self-knowledge. It is here where she speaks about the anatomy of Christian Science before she comes to the obstetrics of Christian Science. So first she presents the anatomy of Christian Science. What is meant by that? By that is meant mental self-knowledge. We first analyze ourselves, what we are, and analyze what is in our mentality before we go any further. And she says, this mental anatomy is indispensable for the excision of error. What does it mean, that mental anatomy? She says, it consists in the dissection of thoughts. In order to discover their quality, quantity, and origin. Namely, are these thoughts divine or are they human? So this is the beginning of it, which says, first of all, we always should say to ourselves, what is the quality and quantity of your thoughts, of your motives? From where do they come? Have they their origin in God, or do they have their origin within our wishful thinking, within our fantasy, or where do they come from? This is already a terrific job for each one to do. Therefore, I think it's a good thing if sometime you take a period where you daily really go over this passage too, not only just over scientific obstetrics, where you actually question yourself and say, what is actually my purpose in studying Christian Science? What is actually in my thought, what I consider to be my devotion to Christian Scientists? Why do I study Christian Science? What is the aim of it? What is the motive of it? Do I study because I want to be a big shot? Do I study because Christian Science healing is a miracle making and that's quite attractive for very many people? Do I want to make money with it or a career with it? You have to investigate very closely your motives. What is really motivating ourselves? Are these thoughts limited or unlimited? Are they spiritual? Are they material? Are they divine? Are they human? And first analyze that. Because she says that this probes the self-inflicted wounds of selfishness, malice, envy, hate. It always impressed me, way back, 40 years back, I went over these passages every day with myself, just first probing, why do I want to take up Christian Science? Why do I want to devote my life to Christian Science? What is the motive? And therefore to probe the self-inflicted wounds of selfishness. Is it malice? Is it envy? Is it hate? It teaches, and that's the point, it teaches the control of mad ambition. Investigate yourself constantly. Analyze your thought constantly. Is there any hint of mad ambition for taking up Christian Science? A mad ambition in some kind of a way. And it must be analyzed properly, so that we, because many people, more perhaps than we are aware of, are driven by mad ambition. They are ambitious, they want to achieve something, they want to achieve something big. That's natural in a way for a human being. It's even natural, I would say, for a man, perhaps much more than for a woman. A man wants to achieve something, he is ambitious. And so we go through quite a difficult period of weighing what is within our thought. If we weigh it, then we should really weigh it, namely, in the following way, it unfolds the hallowed influences of unselfishness, philanthropy, and spiritual love. See, she takes up three terms. They all have to do with a different degree of love. Namely, unselfishness. Is our ambition actually unselfish, or is it mad? Is it selfish? Is it that we have a drive really to the, what do you call it, to the limelight hitch? Huh? Or is it really out of a humbleness of thought, an unselfish thought, just for the love of the idea, for philanthropy? Phil is love, huh? Anthropos is man, love for man. Is it actually love for men, or because we can afterwards dominate men and be bigger than the other fellow and sit up higher than the other fellow, that he has to crawl to our feet and ask for help? What is in within us that motivates us? Is it actually spiritual love? You have those three very beautiful terms that all three indicate a stage of love. And so this is the very first thing that we have to do. And it's necessary, especially with young people, that they ask themselves very seriously, what is motivating ourselves? Then we come to the next stone of love as spirit, where self-completeness then unfolds through scientific obstetrics. We have that whole passage on scientific obstetrics, the birth of the true idea man. So mental anatomy must precede that stage really, so that we first know what should be really brought to birth, so that if our motives, say, would be wrong, then we would try to bring to birth something that is wrong. So first, the tone of mind must be cleared up and say, what is our motive? If that is pure, then we can go on to the next subtone of spirit and see the method of scientific obstetrics. Now, I don't have to talk about scientific obstetrics because you all know that pamphlet on scientific obstetrics, and that is explicit enough, so that I just can go on to soul. Namely, to the definiteness of that self-completeness. So self-completeness demands unhesitating decision as to the proper treatment of error. The marginal heading is also unhesitating decision, and what she asks here is that tone of definiteness of soul, where she says, decide quickly as to the proper treatment of error. Treat error through mind. Don't hesitate, don't let it linger, so to say, and say, well, I will do it afterwards when I have time, I will do it tonight, I will do it tomorrow, then I have time. It is a sense of do it right away. See, the immediateness of soul. So treat error through the spiritual law, the law of God, right away, and not linger along and try to treat it otherwise. So here self-completeness would say, establish right away the perfection of the case and do that very decidedly. She goes on to another subject, principle, where self-completeness operates in an impersonal way for the redemption of mankind. Now she shows that behind mind, spirit, soul must naturally lie a self-operative principle, and that therefore we are not going to demonstrate something to the point of being fulfilled, but we go out from the point of fulfillment and see that the principle of self-fulfillment is constantly operating in an impersonal way. Because they said to Mrs. Eddy that the world is benefited by her without seeing her, and it feels her influence. So why doesn't she make herself more widely known? Why doesn't she go out and hire a big hall and 5,000 seats, 10,000 feet? The others do that too. Billy Graham does it too. Why didn't Mrs. Eddy go out and hire all this hall, give terrific lectures? Why does she stay secluded at home? Because she knew that her labor at home in the silence of the quietude of her room would reach the world much more than these public appearances. And this is true for everyone. I think everyone who studies this science should feel that if it is not his job to go out into the world and teach and lecture, that at home he fulfills just as big a job, if not a better job, not a wider job, just to labor in the idea, in quietude, in peace, and establishes really the sense of principle, so that there is no limelight itch, that there is no seeking for self-aggrandizement, but what she says, that it's really praying, watching, and working for the redemption of mankind, that this is really much bigger. And we begin to feel that if we study at home, if we spend our hours at home, nobody sees us, nobody knows about us, that we sit there and know that the world will feel its influence, and that you are treating the world because you are working in the science of being. And so being is being blessed by it. And if it seems that sometime a situation just doesn't seem to work out, that like being taken with violent pain that cannot be relieved quickly by Christian Science treatment, then again she brings in that wisdom that she says, then a hypodermic injection is the right thing, until you can handle the case mentally, because if you are quiet within yourself, then you are much more in the position to give yourself a good treatment. Again saying, just as at the beginning, that God will still guide us into the right use of temporal and eternal means. So here again at the end she says, prove all things and hold fast that which is good. Can you see, she was much more tolerant towards proof all things than most of the Christian Scientists. They preferred to die if they could be helped, even if they could be helped by a doctor. Well, that's their conviction. They have the right for that. It's not my cup of tea. Because I never up to now have felt that medicine is wrong, that medicine is something that you have to detest to the nth degree. I never really had to go to a doctor or to a hospital, because I have no enemy as a doctor, as a hospital. The moment we build up enmity, hostility against doctors and medicine, I guess we are put under probation and we'll have to taste it one day. So don't take that as if I had said, well, if things just don't go on the first go, take medicine. I didn't say that. But I say, if the leadings of the divine mind are such that prove all things, then prove all things and hold fast to that which is good. Then she comes to truth and says that in that self-completeness no falsity can be included. Very easy statement, a clear statement, that really falsities fall before a pure consciousness because it has no foundation. So bigotry, ignorance, envy, all that falls before an honest heart. You have again the truth, the victory of truth, truth that destroys what needs to be destroyed. And finally we come to the end of love. There she shows that self-completeness does care. You have the motherhood sense, the caring sense, does care for its idea under every circumstance, so that it can never be overthrown. You have a big tone of lover's love, that the standpoint of perfection, when we care for it and tend it and nurture it, that this can never be overthrown. Here she speaks about the motherhood versus the hireling, the counterfeit of motherhood, that flees and does not care. Whereas love does care. And so she ends up with that sentence that teaches about ethics, neither dishonesty nor ignorance ever founded, nor can they overthrow a scientific system of ethics. As if she would say, what I have presented to you in that whole chapter is the scientific system of ethics, and if you adhere to the line of development through mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love, then that system of ethics can no more be touched by anything else, nor be overthrown by anything else. And that finishes the chapter on teaching.